910 AM, W245 CT Hayward, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Chuck Sievertson. President Biden and Vice President Harris putting attention on the economy. ABC's Selena Wang.
Kamala Harris in North Carolina, as she tries to define her own candidacy. She'll tell the American people about her plan for the economy, proposing a federal ban on price gouging on groceries and up to $25,000 in down payment support for first-time homebuyers.
Some of Donald Trump's Republican supporters have begged him to focus on policy and stop hurling insults at Harris. Mr. Trump today says he's entitled to attack Harris, who he accuses, without evidence, of orchestrating the criminal trials against him. Ukrainian troops are setting up a military command office in Sudza, says President Zelensky. It's so far the largest Russian town to fall to Ukraine's forces since the cross-border offensive started over a week ago. Five defendants, including two doctors, are charged in the ketamine overdose death of Matthew Perry last year. This is ABC News.
I'm James Kelly with WBZH News, your news roundup in quick podcast form. Find it anytime on the WBZH website at buzzofthenorth.com.
I'm Terry Bell. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. Governor Evers is asking a federal judge not to impose any changes at Wisconsin's youth prisons after a counselor was killed earlier this summer. Evers tells federal judge James Peterson the conditions at Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake are slowly getting better. Republican lawmakers are pushing Peterson to give staff more leeway to discipline inmates. Microsoft is increasing its footprint on the former Foxconn site in Racine County. Stuart J. Wattles reports.
The company this week purchased an additional 70 acres of land in Mount Pleasant for almost $13 million. The latest acquisition brings their total land ownership in the area to over 1,200 acres. The tech giant's $3 billion data center project is expected to create more than 2,000 construction jobs by year end. I'm Stuart J. Wattles.
That's what you need to know. I'm Terry Bell, Civic Media News.
CapTime's Idea Fest is back for a week of powerhouse speakers and sessions exploring important local and national topics. September 15th through the 21st in Madison. This year's guest speakers include Speaker Emerita Nancy Pelosi, former Member of Congress Liz Cheney, Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson, and historian Heather Cox Richardson, along with many others. Idea Fest brings together changemakers to discuss Wisconsin's triumphs and failures to help reach a better state. Purchase your tickets today at CapTimesIdeaFest.com to join this premier thought festival.
You're listening to WBZH, Hayward's home for the Todd Allball Show.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to. Lots to talk about. How many people remember the Obamacare fight? How many people remember going back to the days of the Obamacare duking it out? And understand, a lot of what the Affordable Care Act was, conservative ideology being lessened a little bit. It was the Heritage Foundation's, basically their plan from the early 90s, that ended up getting a lot of attention in here. The idea of personal responsibility, the individual mandate, which then Republicans used as a massive divisive tool, even though their idea, and a lot of this stuff that were meant to so-called cut costs. And look, I completely agree with the personal responsibility idea. Everybody has to be in. In order for a giant pool, an insurance pool to work, you need more people in to mitigate risk. This way, the fewer people are getting benefits out or getting claims paid, more people are paying in, helps the pot grow, gives security to a lot more people. It's a smart idea, and I'm all on board. But there was one thing that even I said, I'm not overly thrilled with. And it was the idea of a Cadillac tax. You may remember this. The idea was they were going to tax healthcare plans that were above a certain number. Me as a union member, we negotiate a lot for generous benefits. We want good, the best. We want Cadillac healthcare. And I'll give you an example. When I had my hip replaced back in 2019, it cost me like $120 out of pocket. That's the hospital, the doctor, the therapy. That's everything. That's unheard of in this day and age. Now, look, I pay for it. I pay for it mightily in yearly premiums. And what the Affordable Care Act had put forth was this idea that they were going to tax these plans. And if I remember the number at the time, it was $25,000. So if your health care costs for a family was over $25,000, I think it was like $11,000 or something like that for an individual, or was it maybe $18,000? But you would have to pay tax on that bit above what the allotment was. And the idea was on these Cadillac plans was to tax them a 40% excise tax on the part of the employer-sponsored health insurance premiums above that dollar mark. The thought was a couple of things could happen, that people would maybe not have these really, really generous benefits, that the idea is that I have and I'm going to use just because I have it. I go to the doctor only when it's absolutely necessary, and then it has to be absolutely necessary. But it's interesting to me that Project 2025 has reignited this a little bit. Now, remember, you go back to the Obamacare years. You had John Boehner criticizing it because it would have an impact on workers and employers. You had Paul Ryan against it because it would increase the cost of families. You had Mitch McConnell, who cared. It was going to harm middle-class families. Lindsey Graham was worried about burdening those who had high-cost plans. Ron Johnson, he said it was going to lead to reduced benefits. Marco Rubio, this is detrimental to workers' health care coverage because we care so much. Rick Santorum made it one of his central themes of his presidential campaign, his failed presidential campaign. So you have these well-noted Republicans, a party dead set against it. Now understand, they were dead set against it. Why? Well, because it was Obama's name on it. Anything in there, even though they were all their ideas, anything in there was bad because Obama did it. That's the kind of knee-jerk reaction our politics have become. So now we now have this idea that there's the Cadillac plan. They fought against it, killed it off. But now Project 2025 has revived it. It's back. Only now it's going to be, they're saying, $11,200 or $30,000 per family. So $11,000 per person, $30,000. Or it's $12,000 annually per worker. And then I think $30,000 above that. So it's back. And what's going to happen potentially is either employers are going to give workers higher wages and fewer benefits. That's the kind of the hope. Or what we know is going to happen. They're just going to cut benefits. And the workers are going to shoulder more of the burden coming out of this. And we already know that's going to be the kind of thought that's going to happen, because we've seen it play out in other places, haven't we? Now you go, but Rick, you know, that sounds new. No, this was in the Republican Study Committee's proposal as well. This is a long-standing ideological fight for the right. As I've said a million times, there's nothing really new in this plan. It's that they've put it all together, the hat trick of horrible, the handbag of horrible, right here in one document. So if you want to see what they want to do to your healthcare benefits, it's page 7, by the way, if you're reading along at home. So for me, well worth potentially thinking about, because they're telling us again, they want to tax your benefits. Instead of saying, how do we get more affordable benefits so that we don't have to have these high cost plans? They just want to tax them. I got to tell you, $12,000 a year for health insurance doesn't sound like a lot of money. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. We'll take a quick break. Right back with more of the handbag of horrible.
We AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So for the last couple of months, we've been talking about this Project 2025, which now, look, is the Republican platform. This is what they want to do. This is in extreme detail, 900 and some pages of horrible and how they want to change this country. Everything from eliminating Head Start and the Department of Education and environmental protection to, well, getting rid of overtime protections and ending collective bargaining rights and basically repealing the 20th century. The question becomes, how do we educate union members especially and working people on how bad this actually is, which is why I've asked Jody Calamine to come talk with us. Jody is the AFL-CIO's Director of Advocacy. Jody, thanks for taking time for us.
I'm happy to be here.
So, look, you know, we kind of laid out a little bit of what this Project 2025 is. From your perspective, how bad is this for working people?
It is devastating for working people. It is a blueprint, and I think for what will happen if Trump were to retake the White House. And I want to be very clear about this. This is the real deal. This is what they intend to do. I know Trump is trying to run away from it as fast as he can. The reality is it was written by at least 140 of his former administration officials, ranging from cabinet secretaries to a White House chief of staff and so forth, or a personnel director in the White House. It is people who were in the Trump administration the first go around and will expect to be in it the next go around. And they realized that when he took office back in 2017, he wasn't ready to be president. He handled the whole operation very incompetently from their perspective. And so this go around, they want to make sure they do things the right way and have an orderly implementation of their agenda. And that's why they spent more than 900 pages detailing that agenda and what needs to happen. So this is the real deal. And if Trump takes office, these are the things we will see. And it's not just changes in regulations and so forth. It is a reimagining of our working lives.
No, it's a fundamental shift of what America is. This is, like I said, repealing the 20th century. But, you know, the arrogance of putting this down in paper, the arrogance of talking about it in public, because, look, these ideas, I'm sure you know this as well as anyone, there's nothing in this 900-plus page document that's really new. This stuff's been banging around in these right-wing think tanks for at least a generation. It's just now they finally see someone in Trump who's willing to move that agenda or allow them to use government in a way to move that agenda.
I would say there is a little bit of newness to this. You're right that there is a ton of stuff in here we've seen a million times before over the last few decades. It is a wish list of anti-union, anti-worker organizations when it comes to things like eliminating health and safety rules or getting rid of overtime pay. That's all in there, and we've seen that many times before. But there's a lot more when you take a step back and take a look at the entire picture here. There's even more nefarious things going on. The way in which they attack civil rights and undermine the civil rights enforcement and then take Title VII inside, which is enforced by EEOC, and turn it on its head so that it will go after things like diversity, equity, and inclusion programs in workplaces. These are new things that are coming from a very extreme far-right vision for what America should look like. So what we have is them plowing the ground by making workers desperate and more insecure, by getting rid or doing things that will lower wages and benefits and rights in the workplace, and then divide the workplace, divide the workforce by going after people's civil rights and doing things to make sure everyday racism and sexism is alive and well in the workplace. So you now have a divided workforce and a very sort of an insecure workforce.
Yeah.
And beyond that, though, then they go after unions in a particular fashion, which is extraordinary. When you piece it all together, eliminate public. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No. I mean, you're going through all these things, and in my mind, I'm going, yeah, this is stuff that they've been wanting to do for 100 years now. They want to, repeal the 20th century and move us back to the good old days of the 80s and 90s, and not the 1980s and 90s. This is the Jay Gould. I can pay half the working class to murder the other half. This isn't new, but it's just a new tactic and a new way of going about it. And sadly, one that some portion of the American people seem to be a little bit okay with.
Well, when you piece it together, this is what I'm starting to see, is that they, on top of what I just mentioned, they want to eliminate public sector unions altogether, which isn't new. You're right. When it comes to private sector unions, they want to explicitly weaken them. And then replace them with company-controlled unions, so that within the private sector, there may still be some version of a union, but it's more like a club that does what the boss wants. So those would still exist. And then the employers that they will privilege are religious employers, and they will give religious employers the ability to trump any rights you might have. So a worker would have to conform to the boss's religious views if they want a job or want to keep a job or get a promotion and so forth. So there's this vision of a very insecure, divided workforce in this country with less rights, less pay, less benefits, reliance upon religious employers who will dictate how one should live, and clubs of private sector workers who will probably be some sort of power center supporting this right-wing vision. No public sector unions, and therefore no check on government power, which, you know, public sector unions are our whistleblowers when they see things going wrong in the government. So it's important that public sector workers have a voice if we want to have a democracy.
Yeah.
It is a vision that is not America. It is something else.
Well, I would argue it's the America of 100 years ago. It's the benevolent dictator that Henry Ford was. It's the patronage government of the past that, you know, be loyal to the top of the ticket and maybe you'll get a job, and having those wide swings, which when you break this down for average voters, and I've had a number of these personal conversations, nobody seems to think, when you're talking to them individually, that this is a great idea. No one thinks that returning to these horrible policies of the past and putting them into one giant weaponized package, no one seems to think that that's a great idea. So you guys at the AFL-CIO, I'm sure you're out knocking on doors. I'm sure you're out talking to people across the country. Are you getting the same kind of sense, the same kind of reaction back, that the more people learn about this Project 2025, the more that they're going to repel it?
Yes, it is deeply unpopular among any part of the American population, but especially among workers who understand what their rights are and how hard it was to win these rights that we have today. I think the key is for working people to understand how it will affect their bottom line. And I'd love to give you an example of how it will affect a union member's bottom line, which is, one of the provisions or the proposals in this Project 2025 is that they want to make federal employment laws negotiable at the bargaining table. In other words, we have a minimum wage, you know, set by the federal government, by federal law. We have health and safety regulations. They want to say that you can negotiate out from underneath those things at the bargaining table. So let's say everybody who's a union member listening to your show right now, we all have a contract coming up at some point. We all have a hope that in that contract negotiation, we will get a 10% raise or whatever raise we're aiming for. When you show up to bargaining under Project 2025, the employer could say, as their opening wage proposal, we are going to pay you 10 cents an hour and not pay you any overtime. That's our opening proposal. Bargain up from that. And so union members, unions will have to fight like crazy to just get back up to the minimum wage.
Yeah.
You know, forget that raise you were hoping for. This is all designed to make union contracts less generous and cut wages and benefits because they want to replace them with, oh, look over here, there's a company union that you can belong to and be a part of that will not negotiate with the employer.
Or is that been calling them
your voice and your interests at heart?
Yeah, as I've been calling
they're gunning for.
Suggestion box unions. But you know, you make an interesting point on the negotiation side. And I don't think a lot of people, I know a lot of my union friends think that they're going to be okay. That, you know, hey, my union's been doing this all along. It's going to be, it's all hyperbole. My union's fighting for me. We got a good contract last time around. I can now have the luxury of voting on other issues, be it guns or abortion or same-sex marriage or who uses what bathroom or whatever divisive issue they throw out at us. Is this a moment where maybe working people should start going back to where my grandparents were? And it's you vote your job, you vote your paycheck, you vote what puts a roof over your head and clothes on your kids' back. Is this that kind of moment?
Absolutely. I think it was Walter Reuther who said what we win at the bargaining table can be lost at the ballot box. And this is a prime example of that rule, which is they want to empower employers to bust their unions. There was the proposal I just mentioned about bargaining from like 10 cents an hour and being able to put what today would be an illegal wage proposal on the table from an employer. There's also a proposal that says that gets rid of the contract bar under the NLRA. And what that means is in the middle of your contract, an employer could bust your union, push and encourage in the ways that they do employees to decertify your union. And at that moment, in the middle of your contract, you lose your contract. You lose your union wages, your benefits, and your protections in one fell swoop. It's all about busting unions, all about making sure union contracts are less and less generous.
Well, I'm sure you just saw the other day in the what was one of the most bizarre interviews I've ever heard, Elon Musk and Donald Trump, you know, stammering and stuttering over each other to figure out who's going to stick whose head up, which other person's behind. The little gem came out that, from Donald Trump saying that, Elon is the greatest cost cutter. You know, when those workers went on strike, you went in and fired them all gone. For me, that should be playing on a loop in every unionized workplace. That alone should be that thing that says Trump is a vote for Trump is something that a working person should never entertain because of that statement right there.
Yep. Donald Trump is no friend of workers. And I think he got comfortable in that interview and was going on and on and on. It was an amazing period of time in which you're listening to two men who knew nothing about what they were talking about, but felt like they had an opinion that they needed to share on every single subject. But this was, these are Donald Trump's true colors. He wanted, he admires union busters. He admired a billionaire, a fellow wealthy person firing workers for engaging in their fundamental human right to just engage in concerted activity for their mutual aid and benefit.
Right.
He admires Elon Musk for firing people because they decided to speak out.
Now, let me ask you this, because, you know, we've seen Trump's record. In fact, you know, my union, the Teamsters Union, the general president went and spoke at the RNC. And for that and for my disagreeing with that, we're basically on the outs because my fear had been that he was going to normalize what Trump's record was. I now see a lot of my Teamster brothers finally coming around and going, wait a second, the Trump era wasn't great. Is this a good opportunity, I mean, for Kamala Harris to take a look at the Trump years, especially for labor, and the Biden years and go, there's never been clearer distinctions between two ideological goalposts than there are between Trump and the Biden-Harris camp. As the director of advocacy, is this not something that should be on billboards somewhere? Something we should be screaming from mountaintops?
We are doing that now in communities across the country to make clear the contrast between what was the Trump administration and the Biden-Harris administration. We're doing that as much as possible. It is so clear, given the fact that this Elon Musk interview where he is praising Elon Musk for firing striking workers. You can contrast that with the fact that Joe Biden walked picket lines. For the first time ever, a sitting president went out and walked a picket line with the auto workers. Kamala Harris decided to do a swing through, very union cities when she announced, when she started her campaign just in the last couple of weeks, and picked one of our union brothers, Tim Walz, to be her running mate. He has walked picket lines in Minnesota for nurses. He walks one of the Stellantis picket lines. And he has one of the most, aggressively pro-worker records as a governor of a state we've seen in recent years. So she is, it's a difference between night and day between Harris and Trump, Harris Walz versus Trump Vance when it comes to working people's issues. Yeah. And this is not, like you said, one of these elections where you can vote on other issues and ignore the economic issues if you're a working person, the pocketbook issues, because Donald Trump is bad news for working people's bottom lines.
This isn't one of those elections where they're all the same. No, very, very different indeed. And you brought up Tim Walz, who I got to tell you, I'm not sure if they made that guy in a Petri dish, but I don't think there's a more perfect pick to be her vice presidential candidate than that guy. I mean, hits every box that I've been saying Democrats need to check off. The ability to talk to rural voters and maybe move some rural voters into the camp of worker issues, I think is fabulous.
I totally agree. He feels like everybody's Midwestern dad.
He's that guy you want to, I know it's a stupid line, but he's the guy you want to have a beer with or several. So last line of question that I've got for you, because, we're moving quickly towards the convention. I know labor will be front and center in a lot of the discussions, and it's going to be the kind of messaging event that I think is going to be important to compare and contrast these two different styles. In your opinion, in your thoughts, if you're the guy with the magic wand, what are the things, what are the top three things voters should know about Trump? And then also, what and how Harris compares in those worlds.
Okay, so the top three things? Well, I'd say Donald Trump effectively two accomplishments while he was president, and that shows what he prioritized. The first accomplishment he had was he cut taxes for the rich. That was priority number one for him. Priority number two was packing our court system with right-wing judges that have managed to take away lots of our rights, especially in the labor and employment realm. But across the board, the American people have lost rights thanks to his appointments in the judiciary. And then number three, he is a union buster. He has, like you said, he admires companies that will fire workers for speaking out. That's the kind of person and the kind of behavior Donald Trump admires. So he's not going to stick up for working people. Whereas Kamala Harris, and as being part of this Biden administration, they have made a difference left and right when it comes to working people. Pulling us out of the pandemic and the downturn that was happening around the pandemic, the amount of investment, the actual investment in real infrastructure projects, not the infrastructure weeks that Donald Trump would claim were existing and nothing would happen, but in fact, money has been moving. Shovels have been hitting the dirt and jobs have been created thanks to the Biden-Harris administration, putting lots and lots of Americans to work, having some of the lowest unemployment we've seen, sustained unemployment that we've seen in our lifetimes. And the work that Harris in particular did, making recommendations in a White House task force to make sure the entire federal government is looking out for workers every time they do anything, whether they're contracting, dealing with a contractor or putting out grants or awards, think about the impact this will have on working people and make sure you are promoting good jobs when you spend the taxpayer dollar. She has been a critical part of that kind of agenda, and she frankly broke the Senate tie. You know, she was a tie-breaking vote on lots and lots of Senate votes where, you know, we were putting in to place better judges for our judiciary, judges who come from working class backgrounds, who might have represented workers, not just judges who represented the executive suites of big corporations.
Again, the choice never more divided. The posts never further apart, in my view. There seems to be only one choice in this election. But Jody, I appreciate you taking time for us, sharing your knowledge and your passion. Thanks so much.
Thank you. I really appreciate you having me.
Jody Calamine, AFL-CIO's Director of Advocacy. You want to check out their work, AFLCIO.org. You can see all the great things that they're doing. Also follow them on social media. I want to hear your thoughts. Do you see the difference? Or are we still stuck on those divisive issues? I want to hear it. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Right back. Stick around.
The Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH. This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Clouds, some patchy fog, and a few showers and storms in the overnight. Lower 60s slated for daybreak. Our winds will be light. For your Friday, showers and thunderstorms looking likely. Plenty of clouds and highs will top out in the lower 70s. It's 69 at our studios.
The Todd Allbaugh Show.
Speaking of J.D. Vance, if you're watching on the stream, you can see behind me what we're now calling the J.D. Vance couch. There are some reports that back in the day, during the frat days of J.D. Vance, he may have gotten intimate with a couch. So.
You know, I've slept on that couch a few times, but I can't say I've slept with that couch, and nor do I plan to.
No.
The Todd Allbaugh Show. Weekdays, noon till 2, on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So it's interesting that Jody brought up the company union stuff, because as we've been saying on this program, you know, there's a push to make unions for everyone, you know, just not, you know, actual unions, not ones that, you know, go on strike or demand better wages, hours, conditions, you know, not that kind of union, the kind where you feel good. You feel, hey, someone's listening to me. You know, it's like I've been calling them suggestion box unions. You get to put your suggestion in the box and you get to feel like you did something. You get to feel like someone heard you. Now, will anyone do anything about it? Not usually or ever, but you feel like, hey, I've got something. Not going to make your life better. Not going to make your coworkers' lives better. But it might, for a brief second, make you feel like you've done something. And this is what the employer class wants. They want little happy worker bees that they can then exploit. And when they get out of hand, as Trump said to Musk, you just fire them. Get rid of them. Gone. That's why I find this story about SkyWest Airlines to be so despicable. That's why I've asked Michael Sonato to come talk with us. He's a labor reporter over at The Guardian US. He's got a new piece out on SkyWest Airlines and how they're facing a lawsuit over the fake company unions. Michael, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me on again, Rick.
So what's going on here? Walk me through. Who is SkyWest Airlines? I'm sure most people haven't heard of them. Who are they and what are they doing?
So SkyWest is the largest regional airline in North America. And, you know, people might be flying on typical airlines like Delta and United, but they're really operated by SkyWest. And that's how, you know, they operate. Mostly they're based in Utah, operate a lot of flights out west for a lot of major airlines. There's, you know, 4,000 to 5,000 flight attendants. They have 500 planes. So they're a pretty big airline, especially when it comes to regional. So last year I covered the Association of Flight Attendants had a union organizing, campaign at SkyWest, and two of the leaders of that were fired late last year, and they were fired over, you know, they have the SkyWest In-Flight Association, this company union, for years and years, and they exposed that all of this stuff that with voter registration and flight attendants identifying information is public. And when they brought that to the company, they said, oh, you hacked, or you did identity theft or something. That was their, and they fired those workers. And in covering that, I found an employee handbook on that union's website that was searchable by Google. There's no reason why it should be public information. But in that handbook, it says explicitly that the airlines funds and supports the SkyWest In-Flight Association, basically corroborating what these flight attendants were saying, that the company basically funds and controls the company union, which presents a lot of conflicts of interest and is barred by the National Labor Relations Act and the Railway Labor Act. So it's illegal. Companies can't do this because it's so, you know, just reminiscent of the company towns that.
Yeah. And they wrote this down?
They wrote it down in the handbook. So the AFAA filed a lawsuit in October. That is ongoing. And last month, the Department of Labor filed a lawsuit against the SkyWest In-Flight Association because they are there are rules for any union or worker representation agency that they have to hold elections and they have to, you know, follow these federal laws to make sure that members are allowed to vote, that, you know, people are aware of the election and able to participate, and, you know, actual members are able to run for office. Yeah. That
they have some independence. That hasn't been happening. To have some independence, a wall of separation between the corporate boardroom and the workforce. It seems simple, but here it's already happening, this idea of company unions that Project 2025 wants to bring for all of us. Seems like it's already happening.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is pretty brazen attempt by the company to continue to defend what they're doing when, you know, it's clearly. And in this latest article, I spoke with someone who was president of this group, this In-Flight Association, for a year. And he basically said, yes, I had to fill out expense reports. They paid us. They fixed our schedules to make sure that the union was paid by the company. Any communications from the union was vetted by the company's communications department. So it is pretty much corroborating all the concerns and fears that, the AFA and flight attendants have brought up, that this isn't true worker representation. It's a smokescreen for management to, you know, pick and choose their favorites, set people up for management positions, and fend off unionization efforts from actual unions that aren't, you know, being funded and controlled and supported by the actual company.
So do we know, because, you know, here's one of those interesting questions. Do we know what the difference in you know, compensation, what the difference in benefits are, what the difference in work-life balance are? Do we have any sense of what the difference between this company union contract, as you've laid out, and what you know, AFA others have fought for? Is there any comparison? Are they in the same world? Are these folks making considerably less? You know, any sense of that?
So the company will say that they have the highest compensation for regional airlines, but they are almost as big as non-regional airlines. So close to the size of Alaska Airlines. Contract wise, when I spoke with those workers who were fired last year, they were talking about, some of their issues are industry wide, like flight attendants not getting paid for the boarding time, the take time it takes to for passengers to board the plane and then take off. And that's when they're that's when those things start. You know, with the pay and contract, you know, I don't know if how comparable it is to the major airlines. But, you know, the big complaints were coming from, you know, workers just not, you know, whether they have any grievances or any issues or things like that, they're at the mercy of this in-flight association that is funded and, you know, controlled by the company.
Now, this is a fairly profitable company, right?
Yes.
I mean, you know, one would argue that, you know, as profitable as they are, that, you know, millions of dollars that are there that could be, you know, fought for by having an actual independent union that had a list of demands that they could then pursue, that their wages, their compensation would probably be higher than what it is now. I'm still stuck that in this day and age that this actually exists.
Yeah, it was surprising to come across the story and to, you know, see it. I think it's comforting that the Department of Labor is taking action to do something. And the AFA lawsuit, you know, they're in the discovery process, so that's going to take a while. But it is surprising to see an employer just brazenly, you know, use this. And they got in trouble with pilots. They did the same thing with pilots, and then they lost that. So they had a pilots in flight pilots association, and a judge ruled this is illegal. You can't do it. And that was dispelled. So now it's, you know, the flight attendants, it's been a long time coming. I'm not sure why it because this was formed in the late 90s. You know, I can only speculate it's because they're based in Utah, which is not a very union dense area. And, you know, especially with, you know, I think COVID kind of disrupted organizing efforts there. And those are still ongoing there. So there's a website, OOO, It's Time, AFA, SkyWest. So flight attendants there are still organizing, but there is, you know, there's a big fear for retaliation given those two leaders that were flight attendants for years at SkyWest were fired last year. And, you know, that lawsuit, the first lawsuit by the union is fighting for their reinstatement as well.
Now you go from this company, this SkyWest, which is the largest regional airline in the country, or in North America, as you point, not just the U.S., the largest regional carrier. You get this big company that's in the crosshairs of the NLRB now. Now you've got Amazon, one of the biggest companies on the planet, attacking the NLRB, and, you know, basically saying that, you know, the NLRB enforcing any rules against them is somehow unconstitutional. It seems like labor rights are really heavily under attack. And then you put the backdrop of Project 2025, which wants to basically eliminate all of them. This is one of those moments that I think more people should know about these stories, no?
Absolutely, because the repercussions are and the stakes are very high. You know, with the Chevron doctrine being overturned, you know, it's kind of opened up the gates even more. And it's, you know, it started with Elon Musk filing a suit against the National Labor Relations Board, claiming it's unconstitutional. Amazon is, you know, made that argument, and they expanded that argument in this recent filing in July that I covered. You know, Starbucks has made the case. It's all these employers that have been facing, you know, a lot of unfair labor practice charges have been fending off unionization efforts, and this is a tactic. And they're looking for, you know, with Muskie, he was court shopping in Texas. They're looking for conservative judges to rule in their favor. And, you know, the possibilities of that, you know, I did a story on the trend of companies doing this. Now I've seen smaller companies. I think there was a mining company that made the same argument. So it's a delay tactic, because it's just going to, you know, add more court time to adjudicate these unfair labor practices. And it's a Hail Mary to get, you know, find a conservative judge to kind of, you know, rule in their favor. Obviously it'll be appealed, if that happens, but the results that these companies are looking for is that labor law, as weak as it is, they don't have to follow, they don't have to listen to, and, you know, Elon Musk was the first to do that. And, you know, he's been kind of leading the charge. He's still fighting year-long battles of labor law violations that he has personally committed on top of his companies, you know, such as that, you know, some, you know, that the UAW filed a charge, you know, this week against him and Donald Trump for them saying just to fire striking workers, which is illegal. But, you know, Elon Musk has made illegal tweets that violate federal labor laws, and he's still appealing to keep to not delete those tweets. And that's all labor law does. They order it to delete the tweet.
Yeah, no, the teeth in this dog is posting a notice and promising never do it again until you do it again. And then it's another notice. There doesn't seem to be, which is why, you know, when the Employee Free Choice Act came around, they were talking about tripling the fees and the fines and stuff, putting a little bit of bite into the dog. And now with the PRO Act, you've got something of the same kind of language to where you really, you know, you try and make breaking the law have consequences. But the reality is, in this day and age, for an employer like Elon Musk, no laws apply to this guy because he doesn't care, because he knows he's got the money to get out of it.
Yeah, he has the money to get out of it, or to just delay and tie it up in appeals so that years go by before anything is finalized.
And then they have to do the notice. Now, it's interesting you brought up Musk, because Musk and Trump had that little conversation. I don't know how much of it you got through. I only could get through about an hour of it. But he did make the comment, you know, Trump made the comment to Musk that, you know, you're a cutter. You know, you fired those striking workers. They're all gone. You're brilliant. You're the best. You're the greatest. To me, that should be blaring on every news channel and every commercial across this country for working people to go, look, this is who they are.
Yeah, it's definitely the mask off. Two billionaires having a conversation out in the open, brazenly, just espousing anti-worker views, just weeks after. You know, Trump and the Republicans were trying to position themselves and portray themselves as not so much anti-union, especially with J.D. Vance. So he's not against unions, when, you know, in reality, this is what they think of working people.
And well, he's for company unions. He's for the Sky West unions. How can you be against unions if they're the Sky West unions?
It's, you know, new branded human resources.
That's it. No, that's a perfect way of putting it. Maybe I like that better than suggestion box unions, because sadly, you know, workers continue to get screwed over, and the pendulum, well, it needs to swing back. But Michael, great reporting. Appreciate you bringing this up. Look forward to having you back on the program again.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
Good stuff. Michael Sonato, labor reporter over at The Guardian US. Check out their stuff. You know, great stuff. TheGuardian.com. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at Michael's work. Gonna take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1936. That was the day that President Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed the Social Security Act into law. The act was a key piece of the president's New Deal, a series of federal programs responding to the ravages of the Great Depression. Social Security would provide an income for retirees and the disabled to ensure that they did not slide into complete destitution. On signing the bill, President Roosevelt, known for delivering memorable speeches, addressed the press. He said, quote, "Today, the hope of many years standing in large part fulfilled. The civilization of the past 100 years, with its startling industrial changes, has tended more and more to make life insecure. Young people have come to wonder, what will their lot when they come to old age. The man with a job has wondered how long that job will last. This Social Security measure gives at least some protection to 50 million of our citizens who will reap direct benefits through unemployment compensation, through old age pensions, and through increased services for the protection of children and the prevention of ill health. He went on to say, quote, "The law will flatten out the peaks and valleys of deflation and inflation. It is, in short, a law that will care of human needs and at the same time provide the United States an economic structure of vastly greater soundness." Over the past few decades, politicians have increasingly sounded the alarm that Social Security will not remain viable as the large baby boomer generation retires and draws benefits. Yet despite those who seek to attack Social Security, it remains a bedrock of the social safety net for millions of Americans. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You know, it's amazing that here we are in 2024 and there's still talk of company unions, as if, you know, and I guess this is just my my addiction to labor history, my studying labor history of the past, that, you know, when you bring up the topic of company unions, you immediately start thinking about all the coal mine jobs that that had, where they had something of a union. It was run by the company. You think of the Ford Employee Association, which really were just a bunch of strong-arm thugs who crushed independent unions. General Motors had one in the early to mid 20th century. U.S. Steel, they had one before the establishment of the steelworkers. Bethlehem Steel, was another company that was, we have employee work councils. Goodyear was another one. You know, growing up in Cleveland, you heard stories about, you know, because Akron wasn't far away. You heard about, you know, the rubber companies who had, company unions into the early 20th century. In the 70s and 80s, Hewlett Packard experimented, tried. You know, they did a little something with it. Again, because the idea that these employers have all had was, we want you to think that you have some say. We want you to think that you have some power in the workplace. We want to give you the illusion that you can make change and make things better. So if we can give you that illusion, it doesn't cost us anything. You know, maybe a pizza party on Fridays, or, a 15-minute break or something. Great. But if it really means getting to the bottom line, getting to better wages, better hours, better working conditions, better opportunities, if it means that, well, then that's a bit too far. And look, there have been, examples, Pittsburgh Plate and Glass, American AT&T, Bendix. There have been a ton of these companies throughout the past that have had these quote unquote company unions. And here, it's what's interesting to me is it's the old being new again. We're just calling it different things. We're just putting different lipstick on the same pig. That means lower wages, less benefits, horrible working conditions. It's a return to the past. But just making us think that we're better than they were in the past, and we're not. We have the same vulnerabilities. We have the same wants, the same needs, the same hopes, the same dreams. That's the reality. And how do we make those things better? We make those things better by earning wages that help support our family in a way that gives them hope and opportunity. And we have benefits that give us health and retirement security. And we do this through collective bargaining. There are very few true, honest-to-goodness, benevolent dictators. You know, Henry Ford gets this weird kind of status. You know, he raised the wages. You know, he understood that you pay the workers a decent wage. You know, they could buy your car. He was a visionary. No, he was a control freak. They would come and inspect your house. And if you weren't living to the code, out you went. If you weren't living your life the way he saw a life should be led, you found yourself on the curb. And this is what is really concerning to me about this Project 2025. Because again, it's taking us into this world where as I've been saying for quite some time, there are folks who want to bring us a Christian version of Sharia law. There's a segment of the population who wants to control what we do, what we think, what we consume, where we go, how we do it, all of those things. And it's our job to not. I mean, it seems that simple to me. And understand what company unions do. The idea of limited representation, that you can only bargain over certain things. You know, like they do with the federal government. Most people don't know that government employees don't get to bargain over wages or benefits. They don't get that. The federal government, it's usually set by Congress. So this idea that you're going to fight for better wages, no, what they've done is they've limited the ability for those folks to do it. It's almost like a company union, because we haven't given government employees the kind of independence that they truly need. And that as a government watchdog, you would really want. But this idea of limiting the kind of representation and over what you can represent is kind of powerful. The fact that you can suppress dissent. You know, workers who say, you know, I'm not fond of the company union, or we want other representation, generally met with a heavy hand. And Elon Musk's comment the other day is that heavy hand. You know, Trump said he went in, he got rid of them. They're all gone. They don't want to come to work. They struck. They went on strike, which is their right to do. Fire them all. That's their world. That's the world of company unions. And understand, when you have a company union and you don't have the same kind of, you know, somewhat equal footing, it doesn't equate to well at the bargaining table. And what you end up with is a lack of collective bargaining power. The ability to negotiate for those things that we need. Now, understand, you know, as it's interesting, Michael Sonato pointed out that one of the guys who was a past president of this company union at Skyview, they said, look, the company, or SkyWest, I mean, the company, you know, fabricated documents, paid for things, did all kinds of stuff to make it look on the up and up. You have no independence. And there's a major conflict of interest there. Because I've had some friends tell me there's no break in daylight between the interests of the company and the workers. There's not. They should have both the same ideas. They should both want to be really profitable, really efficient, you know, all of that, productive, make quality products. And on certain levels, I agree with some of that. But do you think there's some other interests? I don't know. Like the company's interest to have profits, massive profits to share with their shareholders, or a family's need to have an increase in wages to put food on the table. Seems like a massive conflict of interest there. And understand, as I've told my kids many, many times, if it comes between the CEO's kid eating and their workers' kids eating, well, the workers are going to have to tighten the belt a little bit, because we don't get much sacrifice out of the boardrooms. We don't get the CFO tightening the belt. That's for the shop floor. And the reality is what we end up with is no job security, at-will kind of employment, arbitrary layoffs and firings, changes in workers' hours, conditions, all of that at a whim. With a union contract, you have some bit of security. So you could go down all of these situations where we go, company unions are bad. History has shown us just how bad they are. I fear, and again, this is where I hope I'm wrong. I fear that we end up in a situation where we have to relearn the lessons of the past. I can tell you how bad things were. And I can only tell you how they feel in a textbook. The stories that I've heard from people about what a company town was like, about what having no voice in the workplace at all, or laws to help protect what that looks like. But if you look at this Project 2025, you look at this reimagining of what government can, should, and will do, this is not good for people like you and me. It's not good for people who punch a clock and earn a living. It's not good for working people. It may be good for Elon Musk and Donald Trump, but it's not good for the vast majority. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast. Freespeech.org for the video. Appreciate you being here, as always. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At Rick at the Rick Smith.
This is the Buzz of the North. WBZH 910 AM. W245 CT Hayward. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.